Welcome to the InfoQ Culture Podcast. My name is Shane Hastie and I'm the lead editor for Culture and Methods at InfoQ.com. I'm here with Portia Tung. Portia is an executive and a business agile coach in a global financial institution. Portia, welcome. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us. Now, you and I know each other well, but I suspect that quite a lot of our audience haven't come across your work before. Would you mind briefly introducing yourself and a bit of your background?
Yeah, so started off as a developer 16 years ago, did a bit of work with what was SpringSource, and it was pre-SpringSource. Yes, I'm that old. And moved into project management, development management in tech teams at places like the BBC Worldwide. And then eventually got into agile coaching, and I've been doing that now for... I think it's almost 12 years.
And you're actively engaged with a major transformation at a large financial institution. So what are you finding, what are the big challenges?
I think this is true regardless of, you know, how big the transformation is actually, because transformation change is all about people and mindsets and habits. And the power of one person being able to reprogram, if you like, their own mindset and being open to learn makes a massive difference. And that kind of inspirational impact matters more than ever the larger your organization is as you go. So I wanted to say that first of all.
We talk about, and of course, this area of InfoQ is about culture and methods. What is culture?
So lots of people have definitions of culture. The one I work with is culture is defined by what people say and think based on what's expected of them in the environment they're in. So typically you hear things like, oh, well, we can't do agile here. That won't work for us because of this, that, and the other. So that gives me a good indication of the kind of culture one works in.
How do you change culture? Should you change culture?
Yeah, I really like a much more organic view of the world. And it's almost like about growing culture in a Petri dish, isn't it? And it kind of just goes beyond that. And it's all about growth. And when we think about growth, we look at kind of nurture, creating, you know, safe environments where people can be at their best. And I think culture is emergent of the ingredients you put together in that Petri dish, right? So it's about fundamentally people, their perspectives on what leadership means, about vision, and about the greater purpose. I think very often, you know, companies are created without really having a purpose that is beyond themselves. And as a result, the culture becomes very financially oriented. And when we all know what happens when people focus purely on financial goals and personal financial gain, right?
What would some elements be of a more effective culture?
For me, I always work towards, you know, employee satisfaction or people happiness, right? I think that that's absolutely essential for a company to thrive, especially in this day and age, you know, when you have Generation X who, you know, work to live. I'd like to think I'm an exception. And I have many friends, including yourself, in that camp as well. And also, you know, the millennials, so Generation Y, who really want to self-actualize from, you know, day dot. They don't want to wait till they are 65 and retired and finally getting to write that thesis on, I don't know, Wordsworth's poetry, you know, collection, right? So I think the key thing here when we look at creating an environment for people is to bring the best out of them. And I feel it's both an individual responsibility as well as one belonging to an organization. Because at the end of the day, you know, Peter Drucker said that organizations form and deform people. And one of the things I've always believed in is that individuals, we ourselves allow ourselves to be formed and deformed. So if something isn't working for you in a culture, try to change it, figure it out, move teams, do what you can, right? Whether you're within your sphere of influence. And also, if it doesn't work out, you know, move to a place where you can grow. I think the more agile and flexible you are, the more resilient you are, and the more likely you're going to tolerate a lot of toxicity in an environment where you don't have to.
So that's culture in general, but our audience, the listeners to this, are generally working in high-tech organizations. They are technical people. What's special or different about the high-tech cultures?
So I'd say they're very similar in terms of challenges with startups. And that's what we're seeing is, you know, with startups and high-tech companies, you have very high achieving people, right, running these companies, and they want to get, you know, the maximum results that they can, which is fair enough. But the result of, if we look at the startup movement, is that we are seeing, you know, a high rate of depression, because people feel like they've given it their all. It's their baby, their company, it's their tech, and actually not being able to step back and think about, well, what is sustainable going forward? What is my real purpose here? And this is where things like executive coaching really, really makes a big difference. Because I think, you know, at the end of the day, very few of us have a massive Gantt chart planning out our lives, right? That would guarantee success and happiness when we're on our deathbeds, hopefully surrounded by loved ones. And I think that's the idea, that we need to be a lot more agile minded when we do this. And I think just because, you know, we're in high tech industries doesn't mean that we apply the agile thinking outside of work. And I think if we were to do that, you know, really inspect and adapt and look at options a lot more and look at our work purpose, that will make a big difference. And also I would add, you know, the human ops movement, you know, there's a lot of research going on about not just depression, but the amount of, you know, suicides, you know, techies being driven, you know, to take extreme measures, which have led to the end of their lives because they feel that they need to do something and be responsible. And you know what? Working with techies has been one of the greatest joys in my career, because typically they are very logical, very kind, very responsible people who will do whatever's needed and asked of them. And I think that's why we need to really learn to look after ourselves and each other when it comes to, you know, mental health and work-based well-being.
So what are some of the things that we can do to look after ourselves?
So my thing is play, you know. I think, and I just want to say here as well, depression isn't this thing that happens to other people, right? You know, I've certainly dabbled in it. And I think it's not about clinical depression that I'm talking about here. I think it's just about getting up in the morning and thinking, you know what, I really don't fancy work this morning. And talking to friends, people have said to me, you know what, I've been coming to work for the last 3 months wishing something would happen to me on the way to work so I wouldn't have to show up, you know. And, you know, that's a slightly more extreme version, but I think it's really important to be aware of these things, because if you are, there are things you can do about this. And it turns out, Shane, I don't know if you know this, but the opposite of depression is play.
I did not know that.
Yeah, and knowing that fact and just discovering it in Dr. Stuart Brown's book on play, and he gives a great TED talk on this, just, you know, drove me to create a talk about it. And now I've created the School of Play, which is dedicated to promoting happier adulthood through lifelong play. And, you know, for me, that's become the purpose, because that's the antidote, right, to chronic, you know, agile zombieism or any of these things you see, because people are just blindly following and living the life that they are told that they should be living, right, by adverts or parents or whatever it is they're influenced by. And I think it's really about taking responsibility and just playing more. And play can be so small a thing, right? Having a chat at the water cooler about what you did last night on, you know, in your night out, or even staying in. What did you watch? Was it Game of Thrones? Was it something else? But just embracing and allowing and creating space for a bit of your play in your life really kind of uplifts your mood, and it taps into parts of your brain that otherwise logical thinking and hard work would shut down, actually.
But we want to be serious at work. How can we play?
Now, I know we have a high-tech audience, and this is the fascinating thing, right? Because techies are the most playful people. If we look at the people who are really shaping our world, it's actually very playful techies like PewDiePie, right? There's a young man, he's famous for having made a lot of money by doing, videos of himself playing games and doing reviews, right? I mean, that kind of profession is unheard of in our parents' days. And even now, people can't believe that, you know, you can have a career like this. And that's because he followed his passion and he played. And I'm a strong believer that if you find your purpose and your passion and you're fairly sensible as well. You use lean startup techniques and you fail fast and you surround yourself with nurturing advisors that really, you know, it's about changing the world and changing our lives for the better.
So what are some more examples of play that we can bring into the workplace?
Yeah, so one of the first things I'd say is find a game you like and bring it to work. So there's Twister, the floor game with all the little colored dots and things. They now do a desktop version, literally. So it's in a little box, and you kind of draw a card, and you can, you know, put this card behind your ear, and then you need to touch your neighbor on the shoulder, right? And all of these little things, is just bring it in, leave it on your desk, find a pal or a friend who you're friendly with, and just start playing, and you'll find that play will attract other colleagues who might be intrigued, and even the skeptics. But anyone who is interested enough and who's there with you to play, they all want to play, right? So that's an example. Going to meetups as well, and the more playful ones, you know, do that. But also, another really simple form of play is TED Talks. So, you know, book a room at lunchtime or go to the canteen, bring your laptop or whatever, and just do an impromptu, informal showing of a TED talk based on a particular theme that you've gathered to watch. And then you can have a discussion about that. That's the same thing you could do with the, you know, QCon talks that are, you know, recorded on InfoQ. Little things like that, because actually what play is about postponing judgment. It's about true play and safe play and fair play. So if you enjoy doing something, turn yourself into a lighthouse or a beacon and see who comes to play. And even if they don't, then you can take it outside of your workplace and you'll find playmates everywhere.
So tell us a little bit more about the School of Play.
Yeah, so the School of Play is really about looking at the latest scientific research on play science and how we can leverage a lot of that in our day-to-day lives. So, for example, there's this theory called multiple intelligences by Dr. Howard Gardner, and his theory was that we are much more than just the three R's of reading, writing, and arithmetic. There are actually multiple intelligences, and he talks about at least eight of them. You know, so there's the logical reasoning, the verbal reasoning, all of which we're familiar with. But did you know that being able to grow a tomato plant from a tomato seed, according to Dr. Gardner, is a form of intelligence?
No, I did not.
And when I discovered, you know, when I came across that, I'm like, that is so true, because mine always go moldy. Another one, you know, being able to pick up an instrument you've never seen before and just play it, right? Mm-hmm. You know, Louis de Bagnères, Captain Corelli's mandolin, he's able to do that, right? Where does that come from? Well, it turns out, you know, that kind of so-called musical talent, that's another form of intelligence. And there are other more intriguing things like, interpersonal intelligence is empathy. And then more importantly, intrapersonal intelligence. So being self-aware as a form of intelligence, you're like, wow, all of a sudden that changes the way you kind of eye up the self-help corner of the bookstore. So instead of looking at it in shame, it's like, I'm actually developing my, you know, self-awareness intelligence. And how liberating is that? So the latest play theory is actually saying that if those were all the multiple intelligences, what if the foundation of all of those is play intelligence? Mm. So you've heard of IQ, you know, you've heard of EQ, emotional mm-hmm. intelligence, and now there's play intelligence. And that is the if that were the foundation piece, then actually by playing more, we tap into resources we've always had but might have suppressed or forgotten. And it creates so many more connections and opportunities in our lives that, you know, one can rarely imagine unless you've continued playing as an adult.
But isn't it child's play?
So the benefits of play are exactly the same for children, I would say. because it would still create new connections in your brain, right? Because the brain is generative over time. So people say, oh, your gray cells die, but the pathways, you can still create new pathways, and that's how habits are formed, right? So if you play more, you give yourself a break, you can learn something. 2 years ago, I thought to myself, and my life script was, I suck at music, I can never play an instrument, the end. And I thought to myself, you know what, you're 40, it's not the end. And I wanted to bring the gift of music to my daughter, because I discovered as a parent that you can't give what you don't have. And I thought, oh, must do something about this music thing. So I found somebody who taught me how to play the ukulele in an hour. And then we went to go to a jamming session in a pub in London, Ukulele Wednesdays, if you're in London, go. And I jammed with a bunch of adult strangers for like 2 hours, and we sang the Beatle tunes, we sang Presley. No one told me to shut up and say that I didn't sing. And the consequence of doing that and unblocking myself in that fear and assumption that I couldn't do something has resulted definitely in things like the School of Play, where I would have been worried before about being laughed off stage. But I think the people who really understand and experience the power of play, and that's a lot of agile people and a lot of techies, is that, that is the essence of why we're here, right? Because if we weren't playful, we wouldn't be able to come up with so many inventions. Of course, Einstein is probably the most famous playmaker of all.
Intriguing thoughts. In the transformation work that you're doing with large organizations, one of the things that we often see is there's a great take up and then everything fades. And it just becomes, if we're lucky, lip service and the old stuff done with new labels. How do we make these sort of transformations sustainable?
So I have a theory, right? I think those who have been successful are very few and far between. And I would say I'm on a journey myself to pioneer this. But, for me, play lowers the barrier of entry to change. And it actually lowers the fear, because when we are playful, we are no longer judgmental of ourselves and of others. And instead, we live in the moment very much according to, the idea of flow. And you're able to tap into resources and be at your best, And when we do that, we no longer have to fool people into, at a certain level of agility and therefore you are great, or, you're at a lower level and you suck. That no longer matters, because it's actually fundamentally about principles of continuous learning and continuous improvement. And if we watch our children play, that's how they learn. And to be honest, it's really quite embarrassing when we look at how slowly adults learn, and we can do so much to bring children into the workplace and ask them how they would solve some of our problems.
Oh, children in the boardroom.
Absolutely.
Another element or challenge that we see in high-tech organizations is diversity. You're a woman in tech, part of by definition, a minority.
Oh, and I'm Chinese as well, so it's double whammy.
Double whammy there.
Whoever hires me gets double brownie points.
Well, what is the experience of a woman in tech, and how do we fix it? Or do we need to fix it?
So I do have quite a controversial view, I think, from other women in this experience. So for me, I've been told a lot about this glass ceiling, and I'm like, well, if you see it and you're being squashed by it in some way, then move away to somewhere where there is no glass ceiling. That's the first thing I'd say. So I don't think the notion that there is a glass ceiling just because you're a woman is entirely fair, because you could be a man or a woman and that would still apply. And for me, actually, that diversity notion, I think it's great to have a mix of people and skills. And, you can have men who are stronger in terms of their female brain than their male brain. And there'll be women who will have stronger male brains than female brains. And I think it's looking at the qualities and interests
of people as individuals, rather than saying, you know, I'm building a new scrum team and I must have two women because there are five other guys in the group and that's the only way they'll talk. Because actually that's a really negative way of stereotyping women as talkers, and then they become solely responsible for, you know, starting up conversations, which is ridiculous, right? When you really think about that, because we're all human beings, and we're human beings before we're techies. So to develop our social skills is part of that continuous learning and continuous improvement. I'm not saying this is easy. None of this is. And, you know, I've been on a course today, you know, about agile facilitation and coaching. And our debate was really, you know, what's the hardest thing? And I kind of blithely said, you know, I think human interaction is probably one of the hardest things we do as people. And someone else said, well, that can't be true, right? There must be something harder. And I challenged it. They couldn't think about anything else. And I said, well, the reason I think human action interaction is one of the hardest is because if it were easy, we'd have world peace by now.
Very true. So what can we do to make it easier?
You know, I think we should just all chill out a bit more, and that includes myself included. So I actually started the School of Play because I realized I didn't know how to play with my child. You know, embarrassingly, I'm known in the community as being very playful and doing wacky things like agile fairy tales and games, but I discovered that I couldn't play at the level of a 2-year-old, and you know, and now a 4-year-old, and I'm like, I'm not keeping up, because when they play, the children don't get tired, right? That's the other thing that parents and grandparents are witnessing, right? You think, oh, if I play for 45 minutes, I'll have that nice cup of tea and 60-minute break or half an hour, and I can recharge. But if you observe children play, they recharge by playing. So they don't need breaks in that sense, right? And of course, they recharge through sleep and napping. So they're very sensible. So they stop and they have a little nap when they're tired, and then they're good to go, right? But imagine a world where we can play to recharge, right? So then the idea of work becomes complementary, because it isn't the opposite of play. And as we discussed, you know, the opposite of play is depression, and it isn't work, right? Work allows us to have a clearer purpose and improve our skills, and play allows us to be more creative, right, and resilient. And together, I think play and work will become less and less you know, bifurcated or differentiated, you know, to our millennials. And I really hope very much that is true for them, because so a lot of the millennials I've met at meetups, they're all high achievers, and you know, they're only like 24, and they're telling me they don't have time to play. And I think that would be a missed opportunity if we don't create a world where they can do that.
Portia, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us, and I look forward to playing more.
Thanks, Shane.